This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and together with Health and Living producer Tina Camellia, we're going through some of our bigger shows of the year, not necessarily our favourites. We don't play favourites, but it's more to do with some of the weightier issues, I suppose, that we've encountered. And we can't talk about health without talking about our children, because so many people are more worried about their children's health than they are actually about their own. We have Dr. Rajni Savanandhan, who comes in every month. She's a consultant developmental pediatrician, and she's covered a variety of topics.
She started off the year with a topic on identity development. Who am I? Where do I belong? These are a couple of questions children may ask as they begin to have a sense of personal identity. Identity formation is a process that begins from young. Here she explains.
Identity, what does it really mean? Could you define it? Can you actually define it?
Well, I think you can look at it as how someone perceives themselves, okay, that your self-identity, and how, you know, there's several components of that, I guess, how you perceive yourself in a very categorical way, sort of, you know, your gender, your age, your size, and quite often young children think of themselves that way. And then, you know, there's how you perceive yourself in comparison to someone else. And that develops as a child gets older and of course has influences from the other side. So I look at identity as how someone actually thinks of themselves. And it does include things like your self-esteem, your self-worth, and other aspects of the self as well.
So in terms of, you know, as parents trying to ensure that your child grows up or does not have a identity crisis. I think we're all paranoid about that. How do we nurture them to ensure that they have a positive identity? And you know, are we to be blamed if they don't?
Okay, I mean, like I said, Mira, you know, if we start looking in terms of babies, you know, babies are always aware that they are themselves and other people are separate. And then as you get older, we start to teach children things about themselves, which they pick up. And quite often, what do? We say, your name is, and the child starts responding to their name at one and realizes that, okay, I'm associated with this name. And that becomes initially maybe that child's identity. So yes, we have imposed that identity on that child. And then you start teaching a child other categories about themselves. You're a boy or a girl. So, you know, if you look at how a child learns to develop their identity, a lot of it is learned from us parents. So you can imagine, you know, somebody's given a name, but if you start calling that person another name, they won't associate themselves with that name, their original birth name.
Yeah.
So in that same way that we influence how a child perceives themselves in terms of categories, we will also play a big role in terms of how that child sees their own self-worth or how they compare to society. So yes, we are big influences in that in the early stages. And then as a child gets more influenced by peers and society as a whole, that child obviously may change how he or she sees themselves.
Well, it's a complex subject. The social environment plays a huge role in influencing the identity development of children. So what happens when someone has an identity crisis?
So it's a very static, it's a very dynamic sort thing. Development process as far as your identity is concerned.
Yeah.
How does this crisis come about?
I think the crisis comes about when we aren't the sole person in a child's life and you have conflicting views about who you are, okay? So, you know, a simplistic example would be, okay, my mom says I'm good at reading, but then my teacher says my reading's rubbish when you go to preschool. So at home, your mom's saying, oh, you're such a good girl, you're very good at reading, but when you go to school, your teacher's saying, you can't read as well as so-and-so. And then, you know, that child doesn't quite associate themselves as, you know, I'm giving a very simple example here, but that clash of two different points of view, that child starts getting confused. Maybe I'm not so good at reading. Maybe I'm not the best reader in the world, like my mom says, you know.
You start to doubt.
Yes, you start to doubt. And, you know, and think it gets worse when especially we start introducing children to social views. The classic example is how we see media portraying young girls, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, thin is beautiful. You know, if you're smart and you get A grades, then you'll be successful in this world. You know, you see adverts for tuition classes and motivational speakers about how to get your child test straight A's. So that's giving that child who's picking up on all these adverts as they're looking through the web this impression that, oh, I've got to be beautiful, I've got to be smart, then only I will be successful in this world. So, and if then they encounter situations where they're told otherwise, you can see that that's going to affect their self-esteem part of their identity.
And if you think your child is developing multiple identities, when do we start to be concerned?
I think I would start to be concerned if it's affecting other social development. So a 6 and 7 year old should be making friends. Yeah. If they go to a play school, they should know by then that my role playing should only happen outside the formal classroom setting. So in the playground, it should start to involve friends or best friends or, you know, special friends. If it's not, if it's interfering with them making friends, if it's interfering with them being able to function in whatever social context, then I would be worried. Yeah.
Okay. Are there milestones as far as identity development is concerned, like everything else?
Like I said, you know, categorical concepts develop in the first 5 years, and then traits start to develop as our cognitive skills and our social skills improve. So we're looking at the school age years, so 5 to 9, we start developing traits. Gender identity comes in a little more. And then, you know, things like beliefs start forming, but they start to get more in the adolescent years, the preteen years and the adolescent years as well. So I think, you know, comparisons with others start to develop in the school years, and comparisons within social groups start to develop more later on.
Your message on identity development, Dr. Rajini?
I think, you know, people believe that you're born with a personality, you're born as who you are, and, you know, you're bad-tempered because you're born that way. But I think we as parents have a lot of influence on our kids and how they develop their identity. And we mustn't forget that, especially in the adolescent years, we are still very, very important in their lives. And we are very, very much important in controlling influences from the outside, especially in this day and age with social media.
Thank you very much for joining.
She also spoke about sex education, with cases throughout the year about sex predators, higher internet accessibility, lapse laws, no or poor sex ed in school. And at the height of the Richard Hucker case, Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan did a talk on sex ed, not so much for the kids, but for the parents who would have to have that talk with their children.
What was interesting was that a lot of parents didn't know where to start.
And at what age?
And at what age? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I would say that that was one of the questions that they asked. I mean, when I started my talk, I said, you should start before the age of 10. But I didn't specify how early initially. But I also gave my own example where I actually started very early with my children. So it was interesting that after the talk, when we had the question and answer session, many parents, I think, were still not sure they could do it with their children from a very young age.
What were some of their concerns?
Some of the concerns was what terminology to use. And I think there was one parent that approached me later personally. She didn't ask that question publicly, but she was worried that if she discussed sex with her school-going child, that it would make her more curious about it, and that would maybe make her want to explore it more. And I'm sure a lot of parents were thinking the same thing but didn't voice it out. But, you know, the research shows that the children who actually experiment with things like smoking, drugs, sex, are actually the children who come from families where there isn't much in terms of bond and communication with the parents. So I think one of the things that evidence shows is if you educate children about sex before they hit the teenage years, they are less likely to they're less likely to become pregnant. One, they are less likely to practice unsafe sex.
You are listening today to our Health and Living look back at the year that was. We're taking a look at the various issues that we've covered. Today's show is dedicated to your children's health, to pediatrics. But it's not just Dr. Rajni Savanandan who has come in. Up next, we cover what we talked about with a pediatric adolescent gynecologist. A very interesting show. I remember that because I did not previously know that that was a specialty. Did you?
No, not at all.
And there are a number of issues that are very specific to what she does. So we get into that after this. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. This is The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lee Chui Lin. Also in the studio with me today, Health and Living producer Tina Camellia. Together, we've plucked out a few shows, I suppose, from the very many that we've done this year to look at some of the weightier issues. Today, it's all to do with your children. And on that note,
we spoke to a pediatric adolescent gynecologist, Dr. Lavita Sivapatham, who went into more details about reproductive health of younger girls so that they can make informed decisions about sexual and reproductive health and rights in their adolescence and adulthood.
Why does gynecology require a special interest in children and adolescents? Because I'm not going to lie, until fairly recently, I didn't know that this was a subspecialty.
Right. This is, you know, the question that most people ask me when I tell them what I do. Over the years, I think we have realized that children and adolescents have got gynecological issues that are very different from adult women. You know, a 15-year-old's issues is very different from what a 45-year-old woman would have. And the way we talk to young people, children and adolescents, is very different. You know, the way the skill set that's required to speak to this group of people is very different. And that's why we now need a specialty or a subspecialty which deals with gynecological problem in children and adolescents. And the fact that I'm here and I've been trained tells you that the government also realizes the need for this, and therefore, you know, they've started sending people off for training on how to manage gynecological problems in this age group.
So it's a relatively recent surge of interest then, you'd say?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think the interest and the need for, well, we call it PAG or pediatric adolescent gynecology. It's been there for a long time. It's just that because a lot of the problems that, or the issues that are dealt with are mostly structural anomalies of the uterus and the vagina. Traditionally, it has always been the senior-most gynecologist in a hospital who deals with these children. So it's always been there. In Malaysia, for example, I believe the first pediatric and adolescent gynecology clinic started about 9 to 10 years ago. The rest of the Asia-Pacific, for example, the Philippines, Hong Kong, Australia, maybe for the past 10 to 15 years. But in places like Europe and stuff, you know, it's been there for 30 to 40 years. It's a long time ongoing subspecialty, and the need has always been there.
How is the practice of pediatric and adolescent gynecology different now compared to its early years? If the need has always been there, mm-hmm. have the needs changed or are they pretty much similar?
Yes, the needs have changed. Adolescents nowadays are very different from what, you know, our parents were or what even I was many years ago. The previous focus was always on fixing structural anomalies, vagina problems, uterus anomalies kind of thing. Now we talk about quality of life issues. We talk about managing periods. We talk about heavy periods. We talk about painful periods. And the focus now is more on that. And although in the past, you know, your mother or your grandmother would have said, you know, period pain is normal, we all go through it, you know, just deal with it. We don't want young women to miss out on school, miss out on their education, and do things that they want to do simply because they're having a period or they're having cramps. And we know that these are fixable things. And having someone with a special interest in pediatric and adolescent gynae means there can now be a focus on these problems. And it's not going to be just, you know, swept away or not talked about. We can talk about it. We can fix it. It's easy to fix. We can, you know, give simple medications, fix period pains, and girls can go to school. It's, you know, something that we need to do.
So while we talk about those needs then, what kind of care is it that pediatric and adolescent patients typically need and seek out?
Surprisingly, there is a wide variety of things that these patients come to us for. The commoner problems are skin conditions, vulval skin conditions, like there's something we call vulvovaginitis, which is quite common. In a Western population, there is also a condition called lichen sclerosis, which they come and see us for. That's usually in girls who are premenarchal. That means they haven't started having periods yet or haven't gone into puberty yet. There are those patients who come to us, you know, in the emergency department with some injuries in that area because they've been, you know, swinging on the monkey bars or something like that. And those are some conditions. A large proportion of patients who I see actually have got period-related problems. So it's either too little, too much, you know.
Too painful.
Too painful, too frequent, that kind of thing. So various types of period problems. Some children or adolescents have got delayed puberty due to various reasons, or they go into puberty but they don't get their periods to a certain age, and then we see them and try and figure out what's going on. I think the other thing that we sometimes don't realize is that a lot of people get symptoms that are cyclical according to their periods. So, you know, you can have cyclical nausea and vomiting, and sometimes it's really bad that they need to come into hospital. And this is also something that we can fix. I've seen young girls with cyclical asthma attacks. Just before their periods, they get bad asthma attacks, and that's something that we can fix as well. We also know that children with epilepsy can have an increased number of seizures just prior to periods or during periods. And that's, you know, it's all very interesting. And if you don't deal with young people, you may not realize that this happens. I even met a girl who's diabetic, who's on insulin, whose sugar control goes just haywire just before her period.
Because of PMS?
Yeah, so because of all the changes in the hormones and that happen all through the cycle, it affects their sugar control as well. And when we fix periods or you know, do something about periods, that gets fixed as well. And as I said, traditionally, the main thing that adolescents used to come to us for was structural anomalies. There can be certain types of, you know, true uteruses, or some people have got different types of blockages in the vagina, and those are things that we deal with as well. More recently, we've seen a lot of childhood cancer survivors. They either during their cancer treatment, where they can have heavy periods, and these periods can interfere with their treatment because their, you know, their blood counts will drop if they have heavy periods and stuff, and then they can't start on their treatment, their chemotherapy, and that's something that we see as well. And sometimes children who get cancer when they're really young, you know, when they're 3 or 4 years old or around that age, they can have delayed puberty and have delayed onset of periods as well. And these are some of the patients that, you know, we see.
Moving on, we also did a show with Dr. Rajni with a special focus on issues related to special needs kids. On the back of the success of our Paralympians, we wanted to know, how do you raise kids so that they can excel in their own right? She was joined by learning and behavior consultant Intan Miranti, who is also a parent to a child with special needs. Here is a story of how she found out her son had autism.
It was 15 years ago, almost, yeah. I think he's 70 now. He was 2 then. I really found out because I'd always worked with children and I felt that he was not developing like a typical child. By the time he was 1, so by the time he was 2, I started looking for confirmation of what was up.
And when you did find out what was up, I mean, what were your initial reactions?
Of course, it was really, really scary. I think it was scary because you don't know what path, what future is going to look like for him. I think that's the overriding emotion I felt. It's been a while, but I think that was the overriding one. Even though I had gone through a few doctors and I had read up on my own, and I really felt that he did have autism. But it still doesn't prepare you for the shock.
Parents are one part of a family. Another part, of course, are the siblings, if they're around. What is the best way to talk about a child's disability with their siblings? How do you begin that conversation?
I don't know what the best way is, but the way I can describe a little bit about the way we did it with Andy and his sibling, which is a slightly older brother, Adam. They're only about 17 months apart. And I think what we tried to do was really talk to him about it at different points of his life, depending on his age and his maturity. So when he was under 7 years old, we approached it in a certain way, which was that, you know, we didn't really overemphasize the word autism, but rather we worked on describing how Andy was better than, you know, mommy and daddy and you in certain ways, and how you were better than us in other areas like maths or drawing and things like that, and how daddy has, a strength and mommy has strength. And we kind of used that to normalize a little bit the fact that we are all, whether special needs or not, a combination of strengths and difficulties. So for Adam, before 7, we felt that then he understood and didn't overemphasize on a delineation between the autistic person and the non-autistic, because that is such a potentially harmful, categorizing at that age for him. So that's how we did it. And then when he got older, in primary school ages, we did introduce a little bit about the things that we've been talking about, Andy, all these years, about difficulty in making friends and all that. It has a name. It's called autism. Again, we're very careful not to then, overemphasize that, because we didn't want him to over-attribute certain things to that. And we didn't want Andy to use that as kind of an out for certain things he didn't want to do.
How do you delineate the two? I mean, how do you delineate the child and the condition, I suppose? You know, how do you know when someone is acting out because they're just acting out? You know, this is something that does need to be dealt with. And when someone is acting out because, well, coping with this issue is just difficult because they are autistic.
I think from my perspective, being a parent, I can see that all children go through different phases of their life and their behaviors change. So you have the terrible twos, the terror threes, the teenage angsts, you know. And I try and explain to parents of children with special needs, and I try to explain to parents, like, look, your kid is going to go through those same stages in life. And the differences may be that, for example, if you take a teenager, they would argue with you. They would be defiant verbally. Hence, that's how they express themselves. But a child who has communication difficulties for whatever reason is not able to verbalize their defiance, their arguments. So it then comes out in a different way. I think we also have to look at individual behaviors to see whether or not maybe that behavior is exaggerated because of the child's condition as well. But the basic steps of approaching a behavior problem is still the same. You look at what triggers the behavior, how we deal with it, how the child responds to our responses, and work through that.
Autism is a broad spectrum, so we try to find out exactly what children with special needs require.
I guess it depends on the underlying diagnosis or, you know, difficulty that the child has. So, and it also depends at what point we're looking at in the child's life. So if you're talking, for example, a child with cerebral palsy, you know, is it their mobility that's an issue, or their ability to care for themselves if they are, you know, hitting the schooling ages or the teenage years? So it really depends on what the problems are and what the difficulties are for the family. So I guess for me, when I'm looking at children with different needs, I always say to parents, okay, you prioritize to me what you think the difficulties are. And it's very interesting because, like, when parents of children who have speech issues, whether it's autism or speech delay, and the first thing they say to me is, I want my child to speak. And, you know, when I might say, well, I know you want your child to speak, but before we get to that phase, we need to work on other things first. So I think it's about working with parents and deciding together what those needs are.
At the end of it, their take-home message was simple.
Expand your definition of education, of learning, of success. Expand your definition of you know, what it means to have a relationship with your child. Is more than, I told him to do his homework and he did it. He's a good boy. You know, it could be we spend time together, play music or drawing something. And really allow children with special needs, and obviously children without special needs as well, a chance to shine in areas besides academics, because you're wasting so much potential if you limit your children to a certain narrow field of success.
I think for me, my advice to parents is look at what your child is capable and what your child has achieved so far. Celebrate those milestones. Look forward to how you can take them to the next level. How fast your child moves on is going to depend on their individual abilities and programming, genetics, to some extent. But it also depends on how much nurturing and stimulation he gets from the outside. Don't depend on other people to guide your child's path. I think as a parent, regardless of whether we have children with special needs or, you know, typical children, whatever you want to name, as a parent, we are our children's teachers. We need to be involved in our children's lives. We need to help them, guide them through the path that is meant for them, not the path that we want them to fit into.
We're coming off the back of BFM's Health and Living Junior event, which happened in November, where we focused exclusively on the health of your kids. The edited version of the panel discussion will air in January, so do stay tuned for that. Also, let us know what you'd like us to cover next year. What are the issues that you would like to understand more of when it comes to your child's health? We would love to hear from you. Email us at biggerpicture@bfm.my, and we'll be sure to get back to you, or at the very least send you a podcast if it's something that we've done already. And speaking of podcasts, you can listen to that both on our website as well as on our app. Our app will allow you to save podcasts, build your own curated playlist, and play around with things. And you can get that on Google Play or the App Store. So do check that out. You are listening today to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.